First, a beautifully written new novel based on real-life events that looks at Gold Star mothers and a program the U.S. government began in the wake of World War I. In the 1930s, the government sent mothers on trips to France to visit the graves of their soldier sons. April Smith tells a story of Cora Blake, a librarian from Deer Isle, Maine, and a diverse group of women who made the emotional trip to France with her. April Smith is the author of the successful novels featuring FBI Special Agent Anna Gray. She's also an Emmy-nominated television writer and producer. In her research for A Star from Mrs. Blake, she traveled from Maine to Paris. And April, so good to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you, Steve. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, this Gold Star program is just fascinating to me. Why did the government agree to sponsor, you know, these pilgrimages in the first place?
You know, it took a long time to get the government to agree. It was started by...
More than a decade, clearly.
More than a decade. Yeah. It started with New York City Mayor LaGuardia, who had the notion after the end of World War I that women deserved compensation for the loss of their breadwinners. That's how it started. But it took 10 years to get such a notion through Congress. And it wouldn't have happened without a coalition of women who went to Washington and lobbied Congress for this legislation, which was passed in 1928, I believe.
And the program provided for what, April?
The Gold Star Mothers Pilgrimages?
Yeah.
It provided for any eligible mother or widow who had lost a soldier in World War I to go overseas, first class all the way, on an ocean liner, and visit the grave of their loved one. It included going to New York, transportation, everything was paid. It was a major military operation, actually, that was organized by the War Department. So we know where they stayed, how much money it cost. They were on a schedule. They went from New York City, from all over the country, on a first-class ocean liner, the SS Wow. Harding. They went to Paris, where they were treated like royalty. They did ceremonies with the French war mothers, which just breaks your heart, at the Arc de Triomphe.
Yeah.
And then they were taken to Verdun, to the battlefields where their sons fought and died, and ultimately to the cemeteries. And in A Star for Mrs. Blake, I'm focusing on the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery.
You know, it's such a remarkable thing to me, so remarkable, and that the government would be that sensitive and pay that kind of money and do it just as the Great Recession was beginning. So clearly, there was a pretty strong commitment to it.
Well, it didn't come from the goodness of their hearts only. You know, it was a depression, and it was good publicity for the government. You know, we are taking care of these bereaved moms. It was first page news everywhere. I can guarantee you that if your listeners go to their local newspaper archives, they will find listings of the women who went. So there was a benefit to all of this as well.
Did the mothers, April, have to sign up for the program, or did the government sort of come calling?
The government literally came calling. And that's the organization of this is really astonishing when you think that everything was typed, handwritten. How did they find them all? They did.
Yeah.
But the book starts with Cora Blake working in a horrifying sardine factory because it is the Depression. And literally the postman shows up with his horse and carriage and says, there's a letter from the War Department. And she thinks it's about her son, Sammy. He died 13 years ago. She opens it up and it says, Dear Mrs. Blake, you're eligible for a trip to Paris. And being an adventurous soul, she says yes.
You know, I had never heard of this program. When did you stumble across it?
I feel really that it was fate. A good friend of mine named Nicholas Hammond, who you may know as the child star of A Sound of Music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he played Friedrich. So his family's a military family, and his father, Thomas Hammond, was one of the young lieutenants who accompanied these Gold Star mothers in 1931, and he kept a diary. So Nicholas gave me this handwritten diary on a red Wanamaker's department store daybook that showed me this event through the eyes of a 24-year-old boy. And it was irresistible.
Which is not the perspective you normally would have thought would hook you or catch your interest. It was sort of the flip side of it.
Exactly. It's not. I didn't read it in the history books because it's not in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
The Gold Star Mother's pilgrimages have vanished into time, which I think is a reason I felt so driven to tell the story.
And as you went through that diary, what stood out to you?
You know, it was the humor. He's a kid, and these women are fighting over whether the porthole should be open or closed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lovely thing where where one of them breaks down, and he says, you know, Mrs. Goldberg needed consoling, and then he said, I consoled.
Hmm.
Just really lovely.
I was going to say, this must be a remarkable man, young man, in the sense that there must have been so much emotion, so much need on behalf of some of these women, as it would for anybody in a situation like that.
Yes, and it was eye-opening to him. It changed his life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great draws of the story was how this young man, whose own father was a colonel and had served in World War I, and part of the reason Thomas Hammond wanted to do this so badly was to follow his father's footsteps on the battlefield, and he was all into the strategy, you know, on the military side of it. But by the end of this pilgrimage, it changed his life, being with these women and understanding the hidden cost of war.
And changed his life in terms of how did he come to regard war at the end of all this?
Well, he did serve President Eisenhower as an advisor, but afterwards he joined the diplomatic corps.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually was at one point, he worked for the city of New York, full circle.
How many women went on this Gold Star pilgrimage?
Almost 7,000.
7,000.
Yes. And the number's interesting because we have about 30,000 of our soldiers from World War I buried overseas. And so out of that number, for various reasons, 7,000 women elected to go.
I mean, some turned it down?
Some turned it down.
Why would they turn it down?
Well, for one thing, the government segregated the black women from the white. And it was a divisive issue in the black community whether to go or not.
For that reason.
So we lost a lot of black mothers on the pilgrimages, although in the book, Mrs. Selma Russell, one of my characters, is part of the party because I felt as you know, not a pleasant note in history that may be, it's important to tell that story as well.
Mm-hmm. So lots more women could have gone, but clearly it just didn't work out that way.
Well, they'd never left their hometowns.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a combination.
Well, some were scared.
And some were scared. Some were really older, infirm. You know, there's a woman in the book, Minnie, who has to fight with her husband to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like get on a plane and have fun.
This was going to be an extended time away from jobs and family and everything else.
Yes, it was at least 2 weeks. So it was a major undertaking, and that's the other inspiration for the book, was the courage of these women to step outside the door and go.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, you know, I can imagine pretty quickly that a lot of women just, again, just wouldn't want to face it, wouldn't want to go to that place. I mean, the emotions that would have, and we'll talk about that surged mm-hmm. through these women, it's just breathtaking, as you might imagine.
Well, I did imagine, and honestly, I cried all the way through writing this, because taking yourself there to that point is anguishing on behalf of every Gold Star parent, every military family, you know.
What was the reaction like? I mean, we'll get into some specifics here, but, you know, these women would actually go to the battlefield. They would go to the cemetery, and you know, they're right there where their sons took their last steps.
Well, when you look at the pictures, of which there are many, it looks like a tea party. You know, everything is organized. They have chairs everywhere for them to sit. There's a hostess that takes you around. There's tea and sandwiches and stuff at the main house. It's very thought out for their comfort. They're encouraged to just wander, be there as long as they like. Nobody's looking over their shoulder. It's very private. So it's all very personal how their reactions were. I haven't read any accounts of people fainting and, you know, falling apart, but maybe they did. It's all very individual. And that's why in the book, all of these women, we take each one of them to that point, and it's different for each one.
We're visiting with April Smith about her new book, A Star for Mrs. Blake, about this program in World War I that the government paid for the moms of young boys who were killed in that war to travel overseas for a couple of weeks and visit the cemetery and visit the war field, the battlefield where these boys took their final steps. You've met some of the contemporary Gold Star mothers. What did you learn from them about losing a son or daughter to war?
I saw such pride, fierce pride. They have emblems of their sons tattooed on their bodies. They wear pins and buttons with their pictures, and they are forthright in their descriptions of how he died. There's no euphemism, you know. He was killed by an IED, you know, or they tell you how he was killed, where he was killed. They're very practical. And they have an organization, of course, the American Gold Star Mothers, Inc., which tries to turn this terrible loss into something positive. They work on the behalf of veterans. Here's a very touching story. Northern California branch of the American Gold Star Mothers decided that what they would do is bring a birthday cake to every vet in the hospital near them. So once a month, they gather, they have a birthday cake for the guys of that month, and they also bring them a pair of socks.
Because
they are honoring the sacrifice of these men, and it's a connection for them to the military world and to try to turn something into a positive note.
But this Gold Star program, this notion of paying for moms to go overseas, ended in the 1930s. Why didn't it continue?
The Gold Star Mothers pilgrimages had a limited funding from Congress that was $5 million. Mm-hmm. And when that was done, it was done. They went out in groups of 400 on these boats. And when there were no more mothers left to take, it was over. In terms of compensation for war loss, that's another topic. Mm-hmm. You know, that I think they've lobbied for since.
But World War II, when that war was over, President Truman, members of Congress didn't decide to send women over at that point.
No, they didn't. But of course, the technology was different. You know, we had airplanes that we could bring the remains back. And yeah, in those days, it was a tough choice.
April Smith is my guest. She's the author of A Star for Mrs. Blake. She'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the National World War I Museum. More information, go to the museum's website or go to kcur.org. Again, she speaks at 6:30 tonight at the National World War I Museum. Why weren't fathers sent over, April?
Well, that's a good question. And when I talk about it, I really emphasize this is not me cutting fathers out of the picture at all. It was a cultural assumption that mothers grieve. I don't know what people thought fathers did.
They grieved even more than men, according to what I read.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that men sort of marched on, I suppose. But also motherhood was a very, quote, saleable quantity, I think. Again, making the government look like, you know, the patriarchal protector of these wounded ladies.
Yeah.
It just was an easier sell.
If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Florence from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Yes, it's a very exciting program. The question that popped into my mind was, to the distinguished guest, did you, in your research, did you get a profile picture of the ethnic backgrounds of those mothers who went, like Afro-American, Jewish, Italian? Did you get an ethnic background of those who went?
Yeah, thank you, Florence. April?
Hi, Florence. No, I don't have the numbers for that, except that I know that it was a mix of ethnicities, just as the soldiers were. So all those groups that you mentioned are actually in the book. According to my imagination and knowledge of them. And also, I've gone to the places where those women came from. For example, I went to Dorchester, Massachusetts, because that's where my Irish maid came from. So I feel pretty confident that the profiles in the book are accurate.
What was your own trip to Europe like, and to Paris, to the battlefield as well? What did you take away from the – you went to Verdun there as well?
Well, when you go to Verdun, you will see the actual pockmarks of the shells.
Still.
And when you look at the pictures of it, when the women went, it looked like Syria. I mean, it was – in 1930, it was devastated. So
this is a full decade after that battle.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. More than a decade. Yeah.
Yes. It was horrifying. And so the women, I can only imagine the shock in the pit of their stomachs when they see the real ravages that their sons.
And describe those ravages in a little more detail. What did it look like?
Well, the buildings were knocked down. It was rubble. You could see through the floors of the destroyed buildings. The river was choked with debris.
Even then,
in the historical photos of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the battlefields were very dangerous. They are still today to some degree, but they were full of munition, skeletons, artifacts that were just right there. Even artillery. And when I went, you could pick up artifacts just from the ground, like lead balls. I have a little glass perfume bottle that I was told the Germans used for schnapps.
Really?
Yes. It's still very paradoxically alive. It's like if you go to any battlefield, whether it's Manassas or Gettysburg, and you stand there and you feel the vibrations in the air of what happened. It's there.
That's interesting. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here for April Smith. Tell us about your central character in this book, Cora Blake, and the very, very cold place that she came from.
Cora Blake comes from Deer Isle, Maine, which is one of my favorite places in the world. And trust me, I asked them, do you really want me to use the real name?
And they said,
yes, 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 we want the tourism. But it is a pristine fishing village off the coast of Maine. And she is a librarian there. She was a single mom. She carries a secret about her son that she doesn't tell anybody but becomes revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the kind of take charge person you want in your community. Let's put it this way. When they tested the children in the schools, she's the one who did the urine tests.
And that comes to be her force of personality becomes very much a factor in the rest of the book as well.
Yes, she's a leader. Mm-hmm. And by the way, those tests, I actually talked to a 104-year-old librarian on Deer Isle.
Who told you?
Who told me that's what she did.
Oh, is that right?
That's right.
So it was good fodder for the book.
Yes, it was great.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Mike from Lawrence. Mike, you're on with April Smith. We're talking this morning about her new book, A Star for Mrs. Blake. Mike, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. My father has a couple of soldiers that he has followed that were Baker University students that either served and died in the Great War. They have plaques for him at Baker University on the football stadium. My dad's been to Ypres, Belgium a number of times and seen a couple of them on the Menin Gate, and there's probably 100 to 200,000 soldiers buried around Ypres, and it's pretty busy on the armistice thing. And he'd also been to Verdun, so a lot. I'm hoping he's listening this morning. But a lot of the stuff you told is pretty informative, and with this being the centennial of the start of the war, it's necessary for the public to know about this stuff.
Mike, thank you. Good comments. Appreciate it. Did some of the women leave their own diaries behind? Did you have some female accounts of what happened there?
Yes. In fact, I have the transcript of a radio speech that a lady made when she came back to her local town. And it's just delighted by the treatment that they were given by the War Department. It's sort of like a promo for the program.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Well, Mrs. Blake went over there with several traveling companions. Let's talk about some of them briefly from your book. Minnie Siebert.
Well, Minnie is the wife of, she's Jewish and she's married to a Jewish guy, and they escaped from Russia. And they were part of a little known movement of Jewish chicken farmers who created these mini utopian societies where they were allowed to own land, which they were not allowed to own land in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And they formed cooperatives around selling eggs. And it actually, there were many of them along the East Coast. And her husband is very dominating, doesn't want her to go. So she has to decide whether to stand up to him. That's Minnie.
Katie McDonald, who loses two sons in the war.
Right. And that's something she doesn't want to talk about very much. She has another child who is handicapped, disabled. And the poignancy there, among other things, is her leaving this child to go on this journey.
And Mrs. Bobby Olson, who's well-to-do.
Yes, I love Mrs. Olson. I love them all. But she comes from a super rich railroad family. She's a patron of the arts. She's an amateur artist. And she basically can get anything she wants and do anything she wants. Her son was a doctor, and he was killed in the dressing station that had a red cross on it, which the Germans used as a target. But a lot of upper-class boys went, you know, and it was part of their kind of the general laissez-faire attitude that the war was going to be over, you know, in a couple of months. And Mrs. Olson and her family had intellectual and cultural connections with the French. They spoke French in the house. You know, her son went to boarding school and spent time in France. So he went because of the sense of friendship and alliance with France. And like so many poets, you know, who were killed, it was thought to be a brief romantic adventure.
Hey, how difficult was it for you to sort of immerse yourself back in that world and that time, and so you could offer your readers a realistic sense of what that was all about?
Well, it took 25 years to get there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, why 25 years?
Well, from the time that—
You're a faster writer than that.
I am. I wrote many books in between.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this was from the heart. This was not a commercial, you know, slam dunk. My FBI Anna Gray books are much more in the mainstream. And, of course, I've written a lot for television. So those things always came first. But I never gave up on this story. And the more research I did, the deeper it found its way into my heart. I mean, it's an accumulation of knowledge and experience of being in these places that I think makes it very real.
When did you feel, how long ago did you feel you could begin to write about it?
Well, I started writing it a long time ago, you know, but actually the impetus to write it now, meaning 3 years ago, was because of the death of my own father, who was a doctor, and he was very encouraging of my writing. And when I lost him, it was the first major loss of that type in my life. So I was in my own grief, and I could relate.
I wonder if you would read for us, April, about the moment that Cora Blake, again, your lead character here from Deer Isle, Maine, finds her son's marker in the cemetery over in France.
Okay, we are now in the cemetery in Meuse-Argonne. Cora had lingered behind, slowed by the dread in the pit of her stomach. Having come this far, she was surprised by how difficult these last steps were proving to be. When she finally walked out the door of the main house, she was met by the overwhelming sight of the entire layout of the cemetery. It must have been more than 100 acres. There was still much open construction. The trees were in. The rows of 14,247 pristine stones were stark against the green. The view from up here on the hill stunned the heart. There were so many markers that they blurred together. Or was it her tears? Sammy's stone was located in plot C, row 44, grave 16. Drifting along in a dream, she passed mothers from other groups, black and white, floating in a similar state of disbelief and awe. The stones were larger than life, waist high and of pure white marble. She came to his name, as featureless as the rest. It was supposed to be Sammy, but it was only letters.
How hard was it for you to write all that?
It just killed me.
How did you get yourself in the frame of mind to pull something like that off?
Well, I just kept going there over and over, you know, writing it differently. I can't tell you how many times I rewrote that scene, and it's not just Quara, it's every woman in the book comes to this moment.
I was going to say the whole book leads to this. You're building to this and building to this as you go along, right?
Yes, yes. And of course, you don't want to, you want to avoid cliches.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've all seen that scene. So I want every single moment, I wanted it to be fresh. So I just kept bringing myself there until I felt like it was true to the characters.
Yeah.
That was the important part.
Now, I asked you this about Thomas Hammond, the escort who accompanies these women over in Europe and across the sea. But one of the questions clearly that you wrestle with here, April, is this, you know, is the huge cost this country and so many countries have paid for war. And this question of, you know, is it worth it? And I'm wondering, what does April Smith say about that question now that you've finished this book?
Well, I'll tell you what I say about it. You know, one of the central questions I wanted to explore is the nature of the bond between mothers and children, specifically their sons. You know, Sammy's only 16 when he enlists, so it's a very tender age. So, you know, my question to readers is if you were Quara, the single mom of an only child, and you could have had that conversation with her son that she couldn't have, what would you have said? You know, would you try to stop them? The question is, how far does this bond go? But beyond that, in a larger sense, it's really about the bond of love in our society.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question and my wish, that the bond of love, I mean, when you and I look at our kids and we say, I don't want them to die in a war,
mm-hmm.
why doesn't that count more than all the forces that push us to that place?
Interesting. April Smith is the author of the new book, A Star for Mrs. Blake. Again, she speaks tonight at 6:30 at the National World War I Museum close to downtown. And what a pleasure to have you. Enjoy the book so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Steve. It was great to be here.
All the best to you, April.